Oh, I'm glad you understand.
Call the House Judiciary Committee to order Wednesday, April 13th, 2011.
You got it.
We're going to have, just a second. We're going to go to 3340 first. Representative Freeman was here first as legislators. Would you come up, please? And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3340.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3340 would create the new crime of unlawfully residing within 1,000 feet of a school if a person is required to report as a sex offender. This would be punishable as a Class C felony, carrying a maximum of 5 years in prison, a fine of $125,000 or both.
President Freeman.
Thank you, Co-Chair Krieger and Co-Chair Barker. For the record, my name is Tim Freeman. I'm a state representative from House District 2. Today I bring you a bill that was actually conceived by one of my constituents, and I'm going to tell you a brief story of why, and then I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some challenging things that have gone on in my community around this issue. So a constituent came to me, it was actually after the filing deadline last session, and told me this story, and I honestly couldn't believe it was true. So I did a little research into it and found out not only what they told me was true, but the law allowed this to happen, and I was challenged by it. So what had happened is the grandchild of this constituent of mine was on her way to school one morning and was abducted and sexually abused. So it turns out the person that did that lived very close to the school and was a registered sex offender. And I thought, well, how does that happen? So after researching the law, I found that we have penalties that are more stringent for those people that are selling drugs by a school, but we have nothing that says we don't want sex offenders living next to schools. So that's what this bill's about. It's simply about saying, let's have a little bit of a protection zone around our schools so our children can feel safe as they're going to school and going home from school. I left here last Friday, just ahead of 5 o'clock, and raced back to Roseburg to go to a candlelight vigil for a young lady and her family. Her name was Stephanie Condon, who was abducted years ago. I would like to tell you who abducted her and what the situation was, but last week that person was found not guilty by a jury in my area, so I'm not going to get into the particulars. However, this young individual was abused sexually before she was murdered, and it has been a huge, huge hole in the heart of my community. If there's any way possible, if there's any way possible we can protect our children, we should be doing that here. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you.
We're going to close the hearing on this for now because we want to get Representative Cowan up on her bill. It shouldn't take too long, so we'll close the hearing on 3340 and open a hearing on House Bill 2174.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2174A creates the crime of unlawful possession of hydrocodone, unlawful possession of methadone, unlawful manufacture of hydrocodone, methadone, and oxycodone. It adds safety certification, training, and personal protective equipment to items to be funded by the Drug Cleanup Fund. And adds endangering the welfare of a minor and frequenting a place where controlled substances are used to crimes eligible to receive certain probation treatment under ORS 475245.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, I am Jean Cowan. I represent House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast, and I'm here today primarily to introduce my district attorney, Rob Bovette, at whose request I submitted this bill for you with some technical fixes that need to be addressed. Bob tells me that in the interest of your tight schedule today, he can do this in 3 minutes, so I will turn it over to him and say go. as everyone checks their watches.
You know what? I'm going to check mine, too. Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, thank you for the record. Rob Bovet, District Attorney from Lincoln County. House Bill 2174A comes to you with a unanimous due pass recommendation from the House Health Care Committee, where we worked it fairly extensively. This is about technical improvements to our existing drug laws to take care of some issues that have cropped up. I'll just briefly go through the five things that it does, and I'll see if you have any questions. Section 1 deals with an issue that cropped up a couple of months ago. Basically, the DEA has run out of money to clean up meth labs nationwide, and the bad news is they're not getting any new money. So a lot of states are scrambling. They're facing million-dollar deficits, having to backfill all this lost DEA money. The good news for Oregon is twofold. One is we haven't had a meth lab incident so far this year. We're down to an average of about 12 a year. The other good news is we've been socking away a small, you might call it a rainy day fund at DEQ, for this exact eventuality. So Section 1 actually clarifies that and expands it slightly so we can keep our guys trained and certified to take down the dozen or so meth lab incidents that we have each year. Section 2 is an amendment to expand our conditional discharge statute. This is a statute that we expanded back in 2005 as part of our 2005 anti-meth package. Conditional discharge allows a low-level drug offender to earn an outright dismissal of their case by getting treatment. It's the primary device we use to get folks into drug court, but we also use it for other reasons as well. 2005, we expanded it to property crimes driven by addiction, and this year I propose to expand it to drug endangering the welfare of a minor, as well as frequenting a place where controlled substances are used. This would add an additional carrot for folks to get clean, outright dismissal of the case. Section 3 clarifies a very technical issue in our prescription statute that was pointed out to me a while ago by the National Alliance for Model State Drug Laws. We need to separate out Schedule 5 from Schedules 3 and 4 in terms of referring to prescription drugs, because technically some Schedule 5 controlled substances are prescription drugs, but and then others are not. So we need to just essentially break out the statute into subsections to make sure we don't get a misreading of the statute that so far hasn't occurred, but we're just trying to avoid it. Section 4 repeals an antiquated law that prohibits our Oregon Board of Pharmacy from scheduling an FDA-approved OTC. We've run into this numerous times in the past decade or so, most recently with phenylpropanolamine. The feds and FDA in particular are known to move slow. When we have OTC drugs that are in some cases killing children or young women, we need to have our pharmacy board empowered to act quickly, which is exactly what they've done recently with other substances that needed to be controlled. And this would repeal this antiquated statute that, in my opinion, exists for no other reason than to protect the pharmaceutical industry, in my opinion, improperly. Sections 5 through 20, unlike the summary, it really doesn't create the new crimes of possession, distribution, or manufacture of oxycodone, hydrocodone, or methadone at all. All we're doing is we're breaking those three drugs out into separate statutes so we can track the data, just like we did in 2005 with methamphetamine, with heroin, with marijuana, cocaine, and ecstasy. This will not create any new crimes that aren't already crimes at any different levels than they are currently. We just want to track data, frankly. Prescription drug abuse on the front side of my testimony basically is our largest increasing illicit drug abuse problem in the state of Oregon and nationwide, and we want to get a better handle on some of the data so we can come back to you with thoughtful policies in the future. So I don't know if I did 3 minutes or not, but that's my brief summary section by section of 2174A. Everything else in the bill is just simply conforming amendments. Shouldn't be any fiscal impact from anything here. I stripped out everything that might arguably even create a fiscal impact, and happy to answer any questions you might have.
Committee. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Bovet, I had somebody recently made an inquiry, and it's pretty late in the session, but they were concerned that there seemed to be a lot over-prescribing or a lot of stuff coming out of pharmacies. Are you seeing a problem with that, that maybe there are some pharmacists who are too many drugs to the wrong people?
And co-chair, I don't know that I can necessarily tag pharmacists with that. You know, I do a lot of continuing education programs for them, and I talk to them fairly regularly, most recently this Saturday, with a group of a couple hundred of them. It's not the dispensers. It's more, frankly, the doctor shoppers that are in many cases conning our physicians and prescribers out of more medications than they need. And those are what's winding up on the streets. That's, frankly, the trend of what our young folks are getting
getting hooked on these days, and making the translation from prescription drug abuse to heroin abuse is real easy once you're a full addict. So I don't have any substantive things that I'm asking for this session, but we want, like I say, in sections 5 through 20 of this bill, I want to get a better handle on what's actually being abused and the levels that it is being abused.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that you're not seeing that in the pharmacies. I was hoping that wasn't the case. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to commend Mr. Bovet for all the work that he's done, not just for the state, but this country, about drug abuse. So thank you very much for your work.
Well, thank you, Representative.
Could you repeat the numbers of what we started out with drug houses and where we ended up?
Mr. Co-Chair, yes. When we last spoke about meth labs in 2005, we were taking down hundreds each year. We peaked out at just over 500. Last year, we had 13 meth lab incidents in the state of Oregon. Many of those were dump sites. Contrasted with just about anywhere else in the nation, that's a dramatic decline that we've sustained for nearly 5 years. And again, knock on wood, we're at zero so far this year. Compare that with, for example, other states where Tennessee was number one last year. They had over 2,000 incidents, and they're scrambling and they're struggling. There are currently pending 16 bills to replicate the Oregon experience pending in legislatures around the nation right now. I will tell you that Mississippi followed our lead finally. It only took them 5 years. They followed our lead last year, and in 8 short months they've delivered the same results that we got here in Oregon. And I don't know how, I mean, say what you will about Mississippi, but nothing connects us to Mississippi. We've got two states that are isolated islands that have driven down the meth epidemic dramatically.
Well, I just want to make a record of the fact that, you know, a lot of work went into it. It was totally bipartisan. We didn't care whether it was a House bill or a Senate bill. And we actually did something that appears to have long-term helped with the mess situation. Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure the story tomorrow will be the K-12 budget, which is bad news, but this is the story. This should be the story, which is good news, because I remember that all those years ago, they showed a map of where these were in Portland, and my district was covered with dots in southeast Portland. It's unbelievable the difference it's made, and both you gentlemen were on that committee, and I appreciate it. But thank you, Mr. Bovet, for all your good work.
I did take offense at being with Jenny Burdick called the odd couple.
Mr. Chair, if you could indulge me for just a second, there's a reason that I'm here and proud to introduce Rob Bovet when I have that opportunity for the work that I know he has done and helped all of the rest of us accomplish. But there has been some fairly significant publicity on the accomplishments that all of you who have worked hard on this have been able to make. And recently, some of Rob's statistics were questioned in the political fact piece, and he was found to be truthful.
I got truthometer, which is very scary, because the truth is, actually, according to the Oregonian, and I agree with it, the truth is we've had a 96% reduction in meth lab incidents, a 32% reduction in meth arrests, a 33% reduction in meth treatment admissions, and a 35% reduction in meth ER visits in the state of Oregon. We truly are an island.
Bob, do you know, one of the motivating things for this was to not have children in the meth homes where they're cooked. Do we have any information about how many kids that have been in those meth homes, how that's dropped off? Obviously, it's got to have been a huge effect.
In 2010, co-chair, we had 13 meth lab incidents. As I mentioned, one of those incidents involved one drug-endangered child. We call those level one drug-endangered children. So we went from having well over 100 each year to one last year.
Thank you. Anything further, committee? Okay, thank you very much. Committee will close the public hearing on 2174. 2183 has a pending amendment coming, so we're going to carry that one forward. And let's get back to House Bill 3340, open a public hearing again on that. And I'd like to have, is it Vi Beatty, State Police, please?
Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Vi Beatty. I'm the manager of the Sex Offender Registry, employed with Oregon State Police. I brought you reading material. As an overview of that material, some statistical information. We are neutral on this bill, so this is just in an informational capacity for me. In 2005, 16 states and more than 400 cities had residency restrictions throughout the nation. By March of 2008, there were at least 29 states, and Oregon was one of those, with some form of a residency restriction. For Oregon, it's only while under supervision, and then it can be implemented by the PO, or it can be implemented by the court where the individual, the offender, cannot live within 3 miles of the victim. A lot of the residency restrictions throughout the nation vary. We have anywhere from 500 feet from a school to 2,000 feet from a school or a daycare center. We also have parks involved. We have youth centers where children congregate. Georgia included school bus stops. They also had skating rinks, churches, swimming pools. And they included in their law anyone found to be living, employed, or loitering within 100 feet of a restricted area faces a 10 to 30-year prison sentence. Iowa was one of the first states that implemented residency restrictions, and there is a district attorney from Iowa report in front of you. They implemented residency restrictions in 2002. They reported the unintended consequences of that was that they were driving sex offenders underground. Before the law was placed into effect, they had about 80 to 90 that they could not locate. After the law became effective, there were 300 to 400 they could not locate. There are also news articles from the Midwest and the East where there was actually one sex offender could not find a place to live, so he dug a hole in the ground and lived in the forest, and no one could locate him for 2 years. Iowa also reported that it was a larger burden for enforcing the residency restrictions on law enforcement, and they had no resources to do that. It displaced approximately 6,000 offenders and their families. In the district attorney's report, their conclusion was that residency restrictions as implemented in Iowa do not provide the protection that was originally intended, and the cost of enforcing the requirements and the unintended effects on families of offenders warrant replacing the restrictions with more effective measures. In California, because that is one of our sister states, and they recently had a Supreme Court ruling regarding residency restrictions, there is a study that I've provided for you by the California Sex Offender Management Board. In the Supreme Court ruling in California, basically the Supreme Court ruled that they could not retroactive the residency restrictions. So any offender who was living within those requirements could maintain their residence. However, new offenders could not move into those zones. But the bottom line in California is that the amount of housing actually available to sex offenders will continue to shrink as the limited supply of legal available units is absorbed through being occupied by new sex offenders emerging from prison or jail. That's the end of my synopsis of all that information. If you have any questions, I'm available for those.
Committee members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have another testimony on this bill.
Yes.
Who else is testifying? My question is, I've had a situation in my district where a sex offender was also working across the street from the school. So we took, that's during the day when the kids are there. This bill's addressing where they live, but it doesn't address working where he works and things like that.
This bill doesn't deal with that issue.
Thank you.
Anybody else have anything further? Okay, thank you. Can we have Seth Prover come up and Mark, is it Kenny? Kenny? Something I want to start making people understand, in water and environment, they're down to 2 minutes of testimony. In a day or two, we're going to be at three with the cutoff. So everybody start getting prepared.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Seth Prowser. I'm a parole and probation officer with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I'm standing in today in place of Jeff Wood, the commander, who's unable to be here. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, as well as Sex Offender Supervision Network. it's our stance. We're opposed to this bill, both at OACCD as well as SOSN. Vi Beatty mentioned some of the reasons, and I'd like to reiterate some of those and also mention a couple others. The residency restriction law, if enacted, would severely increase homelessness and transients, which would increase risk factors for sex offenders. Stressors, lack of stable housing are acute risk factors and should be considered when considering this bill. It would force sex offenders into many rural areas, which increases isolation, opportunities for employment, housing, and treatment options as well. Further research has shown that proximities to a sex offender's proximity to a school or daycare does not have an effect on increasing recidivism. There's no effect by the research. In fact, driving the sex offenders from stable housing, stable support systems, social supports actually increases risk factors. So, if this bill was enacted and put into law, it actually could increase recidivism, reduce it. The overwhelming majority of sex offenses occur between people who know each other, a family member, a boyfriend, a mother's boyfriend, you name it. It's usually done in the house, in the home, somebody who already has access to a child. Very rarely does it occur stranger to stranger. And if you want to call it a snatch and grab type situation, those are very few and occur very infrequently. So this bill would encompass all sex offenders, but would probably do far more harm than good. And that's all I have, Mr. Co-Chairs. If you have any questions, I'm available.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. I know you've already heard some testimony and you'll hear more, so I'm going to try to avoid being repetitive. One of the things I want to make sure is on the record regarding this bill is that it would apply to every single individual on Oregon's sex offender registry, which at last I knew was over 18,000 people, and nearly 3,000 of them are individuals adjudicated as juveniles. They may be people who are now in their 20s and 30s who are adjudicated when they were, preteens or early adolescents. We cast the net very broadly in this state, in particular when it comes to juveniles and our requirements that they register. It includes misdemeanor offenses and other lower level offenses, and there is no minimum age for the registration requirement in Oregon, and this law would affect them as well. These may be people who are still minors who are living with their parents or with their grandparents, and this would have a devastating effect on families in terms of restricting their ability to live in places that they choose and places that make sense for them. Even adults, even offenders, whether they were juveniles or adults at the time, often end up living with other family members because their housing options are so limited to begin with. So we're talking about affecting a very large number of people with this bill, and as a consequence, affecting other people in their lives, their spouses, their children, their extended family members, their roommates and friends. So I want to make sure that that is understood, the scope of this bill. And obviously the research you've heard shows that we don't have any evidence that this approach will have the desired effect, but we can be certain that it will have some very undesirable effects. Thank you.
Okay, committee members, any questions? Okay, thank you. They're going to let you off easy. Gail Meyer, Gwen Frith, and Ken Molloy, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. There's little that I can add that's already been stated. I would note, again, to underscore the breadth of the bill, It does apply to the entire universe of sex offenders that need to register. It's not based on risk. There's no discretion to any court. There's no opt-out provision. There's no any possibility to apply for relief. And so this would be a lifetime restriction. And again, I'd underscore the fact that most sex offenses are committed with a person who knows their offender. And so this would apply to all sex offenders on the registry in the hope that perhaps it would have its preferred impact amongst stranger-to-stranger crimes, but those are very, very, very discreet numbers. Thank you.
Mr. Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Ken Nolly. I'm a professor of English and film studies at Willamette. I've been there and a Salem resident for 44 years. My wife has an MSW and worked for years doing protective service for CSD. I say that partly to say that we've spent our adult lives caring about our young people, worrying about their futures and their welfare. A year and a half ago, however, the bottom fell out from under our lives. Our son was called from the Marion County Jail. He'd been arrested for hitting on a child porn site that was monitored by the FBI. Thus, I have had to focus a lot of energies on things I never knew about. When I saw about the bill, my first thought was, I wonder how many of us have thought about how many places are prescribed. And I also wanted to know, I thought, I need to find that out, because whatever you decide, if you implement this bill 2 years from now when my son gets out of jail, I'm going to have to try to help them negotiate this. So I bought a couple of New Salem maps, got a compass, got on Google, and began to go to work. What I'm bringing you, I hope, is a little bit better than that. But I want to show you a couple of maps about what the implications of this might be. This is a map of the Salem-Keyser area. It looks a little, you get a little more realistic sense, especially for those of you who are not from Salem, to see the satellite picture, because you can see where there are uninhabited areas that just appear blank on the other one. There are open areas, but it really wipes out a huge amount of the city. That is so because there are 94 public and private K through 12 schools in Salem, and there are 95 other daycare facilities that we believe will be a part of this. So there are almost 190 circles here. I also need to say that, let's see if I can, I don't want to take too much time to go into that, but let me try to explain what I want to say about this. This is an interactive map. I leave that with you, and you can look up anything you want to look up on it. What I want to say is this is the most conservative expression of it I could get. These are circles with a 1,000-foot radius. Most schools occupy a whole city block, so that radius will be pushed out 1,000 feet from the corners of that block. My guess is that the prescribed area will be at least double what you see here in Salem. But this isn't so bad as, let's look at, we did a little bit of work at Northeast Portland, and I think I can back this off a little bit so you can see a little bit more. We wanted to do all of Portland, but we just didn't have time to sit about to do this. But if you live in Northeast Portland and you have to try to find housing in Northeast Portland, it's really, really grim. I want to also say that I'm an academic. I'm trained to do research. I've done that for 40-some years. I sat down and tried to assemble this. We had a lot of help on this map from other members of a group called Oregon Voices that we're a part of. It's a group that provides support for families who have members caught up in the sex offender laws, and we work for, we hope, informed and sane registration in dealing with them. But On Salem, I basically did all of that. I spent about a week doing this research. It took me an enormously long time to try to find a coherent and complete list of certified daycare in Salem. I couldn't find it on the internet. I could find pieces, but they were obviously partial. I started calling around agencies. I finally found an absolutely wonderful woman named Deb Trammell at CCD who gave me a complete list of certified daycare. But this is not easy information to get. Every sex offender and every sex offender's family, most families don't stay in there, but the ones who do, will have to sort through this minefield in order to deal with this bill. Thank you.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, and members of the committee, my name is Gwen Griffith. I'm a lawyer. I'm with Oregon Voices as well, and we've given you a memo on all of the aspects of this, but I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about my role as a mom. In 2008, my son, age 19, was convicted in Minnesota of the crime that I call teenage sex. He did 90 days in jail there and was returned to Oregon in 2009. I had just moved to Portland. I had downsized thinking that I was an empty nester, living in a rented apartment in the size of a postage stamp. So I needed to find a place. Our family had decided that it would be best if he lived with us. Great. I am every landlord's dream tenant. Middle-aged woman, good credit score, good job, no cats. I was turned down 8 times in a row for rental housing for an apartment in Portland. The rental applications say, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Well, no. Has anyone who will ever reside in this residence been convicted of a felony or any sex crime, whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony? I was turned down 8 times, so of course I called my son's probation officer. She's a very nice woman. I said, what do families do in cases like this? And she said, well, Gwen, I have a list of places that you could look at that allow sex offenders to live, but let me tell you, you won't want to live in any of them. I've lived in lots of places. I went to look, and I would predict that none of you would have advised me to live there. So the choice was very stark for me. If I wanted to provide a stable home for my son during this time of his transition, it was lie or buy. I'm not going to lie about it for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of which is I'm not ashamed of my son. I'm proud of my son and how he's come through this. So I bought a place. And I'm acutely aware that I solved this problem with money, because I can do that. The families that we work with in Oregon Voices do not have those options. The other moms, the other grandmothers, the other aunts, uncles, and sisters and brothers cannot just go out and buy a condo in downtown Portland. So what we've created with this system is a situation in which what I think society wants us to do, which is to provide support, stability, love for our family members as they make this transition, is not possible. And that is exactly what the PO said to me. She said, in many cases, the offender will not be able to live with family. So these are private landlords that are saying this. What does this have to do with 3340? Two things. First, I believe that legislation like this just fans the flames of fear. It is fear-based legislation that simply does not work in the real world. And of course, landlords have caught the virus of fear and think that all sex offenders are alike and are lurking behind bushes. I would encourage you to do whatever you can to dampen down that fear and to enact evidence-based approaches to sex offender management. But more important, for me as a mom, these kinds of things blow families apart. The families are bankrupted financially, emotionally, and they get through it somehow. What I was trying to do in 2009 was to paste my family back together. There's no support for that in the outside world. So I would say anything you can do to help us put our families back together is a good thing, and don't make it harder for us to put our families back together. Thank you for your attention.
Okay. Committee, you got any questions? Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on 3340 and open a public hearing on 3594.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3594 would create the offense of refusal to identify oneself to a peace officer, punishable by a maximum fine of $720 as a Class A violation. This crime would occur if an individual, having been present at the scene of a felony within 6 hours of the incident, and after having been specifically informed by a police officer that the person's identity and residence address are requested in connection with that investigation, refuses to provide that information or fails to provide it accurately.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. Jeff Barker, State Representative from House District 28. With this bill, the intent of this bill, there's been cases where there's been a crime scene, the police arrive, there's a crowd there or a group of people, and they refuse to identify themselves. And this would not require them to make a statement as to what they saw or didn't see. It would just identify who is there to help them in future investigations. They would know who to contact, and they also would know who was there, so that later on, should there be an arrest and a trial, if other people came and said, well, I was there, they would know whether they were or not. This would also help the defense bar. For example, one time I was involved in a case where there was a crowd about like this that's behind me in a bar, and there had been a shooting, and everybody had been in the bathroom when it took place. Nobody had seen a thing. That would have been good to know who they were, just for the future investigations. It would help if, for example, all of you were at a scene of a crime, you didn't give your identification to police, and then Mr. Knott was the suspect, he becomes arrested. Gail Myers appointed his attorney. She said, who was there? Who saw what happened? He said, well, there was 8 other people there, but I don't know their names. She then cannot, the defense cannot investigate thoroughly, as they need to do to defend the citizen. So that's part of this. The bill is a little bit too broad right now. I think 6 hours is too long. I met this morning with the other Ms. Meyer from ACLU, and we talked about some problems in it. It needs some additional work. But the idea behind it, the purpose of it, is just for people to be identified who are actually at a crime scene, so the police know who was there and by default who was not there. And it just would be helpful to them to be able to have that information. It takes, in some places, some groups of people, there's a machoism where you're not going to talk to the police. If you're required to, then everybody can do it. It's kind of like when we used to have in police shootings, you didn't have to go see a psychologist, but you could if you wanted to, so nobody went. And now that it's required, everybody goes and they get the treatment they need. So it's the same kind of just basic thing of just trying to help solve a problem, but it does need more work. And so I ask that it be carried over from today. Thank you.
Okay, committee members, do you have any questions?
Thank you.
You did pretty good. You were 4 minutes. That means I'll let everybody else have 4 minutes.
We have Gail Myers and Andrea. Meyer, come up, please. Ladies, you got 4 minutes, the same as the presenter of the bill.
4 minutes total?
You can have 3 of mine.
Okay. Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I do want to thank Co-Chair Barker in recognizing the need for everybody to know who was at a scene, who saw something, who didn't. What gives us concern about the bill is the
length and breadth of the detention period for the purpose of compelling someone to identify themselves when that individual is not suspected of any individualized wrongdoing themselves. I've written written testimony. It gets pretty deep into the weeds with search and seizure and vagueness case law. I'll leave it at that. I know that there's an interest of the co-chair to do this the right way, not the wrong way, and we would certainly be very happy to have those discussions.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, also here in opposition to House Bill 3594 because we believe it has significant constitutional issues. You know, it's a good thing I keep files because I don't always remember things, but what I'm passing around to you is a legislative council opinion written in 2005. Little did I remember, actually, that we'd had a hearing on this proposal 6 years ago, and Elsie had opined on the constitutional vulnerabilities of this proposal as well. So in light of that and the testimony from the OCDLA that you have and the chair's discussions about future conversations, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any members? Okay, thank you.
Less than 4 minutes.
Good job.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3594 and 2103. We're looking for an amendment for House Bill 2103, so we're going to carry it forward, and we'll open a public hearing on 2547. Is she coming, is she?
Committee. Apologize for the brief delay. House Bill 2547 was previously heard on March 1st. It has both Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, neither of which has been moved into the bill. The Dash 2 amendments incorporate the Dash 1, and as to those amendments, excuse me, there's no revenue impact and an indeterminate fiscal impact. There was a subsequent referral to revenue. This is a measure that allows a state agency to serve notice of garnishment via regular mail instead of certified mail. Return receipt requested. It's primarily a cost-saving measure for the Department of Revenue. Declares emergency effective on passage. The Dash 2 amendment would allow all means available to communicate and would require the use of certified mail for notices of action. It would prohibit sanctions on the Dash 2 for noncompliance unless notice was proper. And I'm not sure if anyone here is for here from the Department of Revenue to clarify if there are any questions. Excuse me.
Anyone here from the Department of Revenue?
My office.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. I think the explanation covered everything in the Dash 2 amendment, unless you have questions.
Any members, any questions of what the amendments do? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
You got a good walk.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2547 to
we have with the
Dash 2.
Dash
2
is in.
Okay, we'll put them in. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2547.
Okay, Co-Chair Barker moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2547. Any objections? Amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2547 with a subsequent referral to the revenue.
Okay, Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2547 as amended to revenue. Any discussion on the bill? Call the roll.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative
Shockler.
Aye. Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative
Wong. Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Excuse.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries.
would have to be a carrier of the bill.
Let's go to revenue. That's right. Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 2648.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 2648 was previously heard on February the 10th, but today's work session is scheduled for the purpose of making a brief record on the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. I don't believe there's anyone available to testify. Both of the amendments, they don't compete with each other, and they are both gut and stuff replacement amendments. The Dash 1s replace the measure and allow persons who use physical force in the care or supervision of incompetent persons to be criminally charged. Current law allows them reasonable use of force to be accepted from criminal charges. The Dash 2 amendment also replaces the measure, requires the court to use a start date for commitment purposes, the commitment start date, and to grant day-for-day credit for time already committed when it calculates the maximum amount of time a person may be committed due to an inability to aid or assist in their defense. As, again, I said, I don't believe that anyone is available to testify, and we wanted to make the record of the amendments. It is available on the shared drive, and I believe on the summary of the amendments, I believe the amendments should be available as well.
Was this Representative Gelser's bill?
That's correct. The Dash 1 amendments were a previous bill that was sponsored by Representative Gelser. That's correct.
Thank you. And what we'll do is we'll carry that bill over until Representative Gelser can come testify before the committee. Close the work session on House Bill 2648. Open a work session on House Bill 2662. Council.
Chairs and members of the committee, 2662 was previously heard on the 6th and was carried over until today because we are waiting and still waiting for a fiscal impact. If you'd care to summarize further, I can, but if you'd carry it over, the fiscal is still not available. Christie checks throughout the hearings.
We'll carry over House Bill 2662. Close the work session. Open a work session of House Bill 2691.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 2691. Christie has just checked again. We are waiting for one revenue statement on the Dash 5s in order to work that bill.
Okay. Close the work session of House Bill 2691.
And would the chair carry that one over as well?
Sorry?
Carry over as well.
Carry it over as well.
Thank you.
We are going to carry over House Bill 3295.
3323 is ready.
Open a work session on House Bill 3323.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3323 makes a modification of the definition of visual depiction in crimes relating to child pornography. It also modifies the definition of knowingly or possess and control as it pertains to a visual recording of child pornography. Recall that, in essence, this bill is targeted to try to capture instances in response to a court of appeals decision where an individual is accessing pornography over the Internet but isn't actually downloading it. So the change in definition would allow for that to be incorporated in prosecution. Also, knowingly possess would include knowingly accesses or views a visual depiction of sexually explicit conduct. And there is no revenue impact for this. This is the introductory measure of the bill. It is projected to have minimal fiscal impact.
Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3323 to Ways and Means. Okay, just to the floor to do pass then. Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3323 to the floor to do pass. Is there any discussion? 3323.
This is the one that corrected the, where the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals said they had an issue. We had a staff working on a correction that same day the ruling came out. Yeah. Okay, call the roll, please.
As filed. No amendment.
And no amendment.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative
Olson.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative
Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wiedemann.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hitch.
Excused.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krueger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson, you've been working on the same topic, so I'll have you carry the bill, please. I want to go back. We carried over a bill. House Bill 21, they're gone already? Okay. Okay, thank you. We had some witnesses here we didn't realize, and so before we carried that over, they've already gone. Okay. 2705 is carryover. Carry forward. House Bill, open a work session on House Bill 3376.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3376 would allow the setting aside of a Class B felony, of a conviction of a Class B felony, if at least 20 years have elapsed from either the date of conviction or the release from prison from for the conviction, whichever is later, and the person has not been convicted of or arrested for any other offense excluding motor vehicle violations after the date of the conviction be set aside. This would not apply to person felonies. There are no amendments to this bill. It's projected to have no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
And all the person crimes are out. Right.
Yeah, it's that's out in the intro version.
Okay. Is there any discussion about this bill? Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative
Olson.
Aye.
Representative
Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative
Tomei. Aye. Representative Wiedemann.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hitch.
Excused.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krueger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye.
Motion carries. We'll ask Representative Barker to carry the bill. Any further business to come before the committee? Adjourned.